Welcome to the Water Entrepreneur Podcast. This program features a series of interviews exploring the origin stories of startup founders, early adopters, and innovation champions related to their personal, technical, business, organizational, and financial journeys. This podcast is sponsored by Astera, the leader in remote Earth observation technology for the water business. Support is also supplied by Imagine H2O, envisioning and building solutions with the world's best water entrepreneurs. And now, live from beautiful downtown Encinitas, your host, Paul Gagliardo. Welcome and thanks for joining me today. This is episode 3 of the Water Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Gagliardo. And today I'm very excited to have as my guest, Daniel Zalante, CEO and co-founder and co-inventor of Zilper, an assisted dynamic boring machine for trenchless pipe installation. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for being a water entrepreneur and appearing on the show.
Thanks, Paul. It's a pleasure. Happy to be here.
Terrific. So water pipelines in the United States were designed to last 50 years. Many are already 100 years old. Utilities typically plan on replacing pipe at a rate of about a half to 1% a year. Thus, some pipe's going to be in the ground 200 years before it's replaced. Over 90% of the cost to repair and place an underground pipe is related to digging up the street, not to mention the impact of traffic. A low-cost trenchless technology can help utilities better manage their underground linear assets. So Daniel, tell me, you know, how did you get into this? I mean, besides the issues I just kind of laid out, you know, what made you get into the business of building a mechanical mole machine?
Well, truth be told, when I was growing up I grew up in Venezuela in South America. And down there, the issue of not upgrading existing pipelines was even worse than in what it is in the US currently. Governments tend to not look at these type of like underground utilities until like there is a massive shortage of water, or like the leaks are so big that that it's the street starts falling apart, that kind of situation. So down there was a point in Venezuela when I was growing up where we would get water twice a week, not because we didn't have pipes that would bring the water, but because the leakage was so big that they wouldn't. It was just, you know, as an environmental disaster to have that water line open 24/7. So they would just pump water twice a week to get to our house. So since I was young, I was exposed to some of the challenges of water infrastructure. And eventually my brother who's my co-founder, got into the industry. He's a mechanical engineer, and he started working as a trenchless expert, selling machines in South America, but also providing tech support, and ended up working for a contractor that was doing this type of work of installing underground pipelines without using a trench or without trenching. And while he was working in the industry, I was studying at MIT. I was doing my MBA in entrepreneurship and innovation. And over Christmas dinner, one of those dinner conversations, he was telling me about like an exciting solution he created while, you know, he faced some issues when installing new pipelines. And then at that same point, I was focusing on entrepreneurship and innovation at MIT. And I was like, this is a perfect match. We've always worked together. We've always done things together. I'm finally getting into the water sector, and it's with infrastructure and with a new technology. So why don't we join forces and start this business and see what happens, right? Ended up signing up for the MIT 100K competition, which at MIT is the most prestigious one. We ended up, there are like three phases of that competition, depending on the stage of the idea. We ended up signing up for the second stage, which is called Accelerate. That one we did not win because, anyways, we had to improve our pitch quite a bit. But then for the final and most prestigious version, the launch version, we ended up winning the Audience Choice Award. We reached the finals, won the Audience Choice Award with our technology. And then that gave us the initial $20,000 that we used for quitting, in his case, quit his job and go full time on Silver. And that's when the company really started.
Interesting story. I have to say, you know, I have a brother and three sisters. I cannot even imagine working with them. There would be no way I could do that. I mean, do you find that that is like the most natural thing in the world for you? Do you, you know, I mean, is there any sibling rivalries? I mean, how does that how does that work out for you guys?
I mean, it's interesting because many people have asked me that same question. And I guess the best way to answer that is that we both respect pretty much our expertise. So Roberto, he's a genius when it comes to engineering and designing solutions. And he understands that I'm much better at business development and the, you know, business stuff, right? So the fact that we don't overlap too much really helps. And then the second benefit of being brothers is like, there's no way you quit. Like, at least in my mind, it's like, you're giving up on family at that point, right? Like, you could, if, and it has happened in the past, like, you could yell to each other, but, you know, pretty much 2 hours later, you're like having dinner together with the family. And like, so you don't let that scale. Like, you, at least we come from Italians, Italian family, and Italians tend to be very united. At least in the family. So even when we have issues, we always, you know, get back to work and move forward.
That's all four of my grandparents were born in the old country in Italy. So I, you know, I can relate to that. I mean, we love each other, but like I said, I'm not sure I could. My dad asked me to work for him, you know, way back when, and, you know, almost did, but I had already moved out to California and wasn't quite ready to move back to New York. So I kind of had to gracefully decline that particular offer. So you mentioned you got some grant money out of that first competition. How did the kind of the fundraising part go for, because for you, you've got a fairly capital intensive device. Yep. So it seemed like you would need a significant amount of funding even to build the first one. So how did you parlay that initial, kind of competition winning cash, you know, besides into paying your brother's rent into the next round of funding?
Well, that's a great question, Paul. And the reason why I think it's so great, it's because one of the biggest challenges that we faced was fundraising. We are not, and I'm going to be very clear about it, we are not a sexy startup. Like, at least most people would not consider hardware and water as sexy. Like, the combination of the two, even less, right? So it was not a typical software startup that just with a PowerPoint deck would like raise, you know, $5 million. At least for us, that was really hard. Plus, I was new in the U.S. Even though I had great connections through MIT, I had to start developing them from scratch, right? So it was really hard to raise. But the beauty about that is like it made us really, really frugal and allowed us, like we built the company on a bootstrapping mentality, even when we had money. So for example, the first machine was fully financed and paid for by a customer. And we're talking about $160,000prototype. And it was a prototype. Then the second machine it was financed by investors, but we got so good at reducing costs because like we didn't have any money to spare that we ended up saving like 45% on the manufacturing cost of the second machine by building like long-term partnerships with key suppliers. Like, so that mentality was really helpful. And that said, it was really, really useful for us early on to go to all these like pitch competitions and that ended us, I think we ended up raising just like 100K or 150K between like startup competitions and grants that we receive. Imagine H2O helped us a bit as well with connections and more. And we only raised so far about 600K, more or less. And with that, we've built a company that is now 30 employees. It's hitting to 30 employees.
Oh, wow.
By bootstrapping.
Fantastic. Yeah, one of the things that when I was working at American Water, I was their innovation director, and we kind of had this series of things that, you know, you had an idea, then you had an invention, then you had an innovation, you know, and the idea was just, you know, a pipe dream. You know, the invention, you know, it may have been something that worked, but, you know, until it became an innovation and something you could actually sell and had value, you know, it didn't really make that much of a difference. So, I mean, I assume there was some level of iteration in your device over some period of time. I mean, did you end up having, like, you know, building a little tiny one of these and then a bigger one? Or, I mean, how did you go from that, you know, your brother's idea, and I'm assuming you filed for patents and things, you know, to a full-scale device? And then I'm really curious to know how you convince that first customer to actually put up some money on, you know, two guys and a machine, you know, kind of make that happen. That I want to know.
Yeah. So it's quite interesting. So the first machine ever built was not even a machine. It was just like testing the concepts. And that's something my brother did while he was working at the contracting company. It's among the biggest and largest contractors in Colombia that does pipeline for water and sewage. And it was like, because they got stuck in a project. So like the science behind our tech is a combination of hydraulic force with pneumatic impacts. So he tried to simulate that by, he had a pipe rammer, which generated the impacts, but then needed something that would add extra pressure. And he just like used an excavator to push the thing to simulate the effects of the static pressure that the pipe needed. I don't want to get too technical on this, but long story short, it was not really even a machine at that point. Then when that worked, one day he gets a call for another project. He became really well known in the industry for solving problems. So like he got another call like saying, hey, we're having, you know, problems with a pipe rammer, which, you know, provides pneumatic impacts. Because we haven't been able to complete that project. So it's two pipelines, 16 inches, and one is 16 inches in diameter, the second is 30 inches. We were supposed to install like 24 meters, that's like 70 feet or so. And like after 2 meters, the machine just wouldn't move forward. So like, can you help us with that? And at that point, we very small scale prototype, handmade, that would add hydraulic force to it. And it did help us a lot. And we ended up completing the two crossings successfully. And it was that same customer, after we helped them with that, that agreed, said like, you know, I'm now interested in the real thing. Because if this was a prototype, like, yeah, I want the real thing. And he was like, that customer is the one that financed their first full-scale machine. When he faced another project that had similar challenges, he's like, okay, the one machine we built is not going to be enough. Let's build the real thing now. Now I trust you. And I think it comes down to solving a real problem, like finding a pain that was like so hard and like so painful to them that they would risk 160K to manufacture a machine.
Right, sure. So so this was a contractor. Is that what you're seeing the bulk of your customers being, actual contractors installing the pipe? Do you see them as engineering firms or utilities? What's your customer base these days?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's mainly contractors. But there are many stakeholders involved. So the city or the utility company wants a new pipeline to be installed for either sewer or water, or stormwater as well. And so they care more about saving money and making it as affordable as possible. And then making sure that if they can reduce the impact on the city, because it does have some economic impacts, shutting down like an important highway, they will definitely prefer that, right? As long as the cost makes sense. Then there's the engineering firms who are hired by the utility companies to actually design the project and select the methodology for each pipeline, right? How to install each pipeline. So that's a different type of customer. I would call it stakeholders because they don't buy anything from us. But it's important to talk to them and show them that, hey, transient technologies used to be expensive, not anymore. Look what we can do at the cost that we can achieve. And they start speccing in the projects, including our technology as part of the solutions to their projects. That already happened in Colombia. We just got our first project that went out for bid, and it included our tech. And it's amazing too when that happens, because it does bring a lot of customers in, it expands your brand, and it builds credibility. And then the final customer is the one that uses the machine, who is the contractor.
Right. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I work for government agencies, and if you wanted to use a new technology, sometimes you had to convince the procurement office to allow a sole source for this, or as you said, you get the engineering company to at least identify the technique that you want to use or you want to deploy that may be different from the standard methodology. And it's always hard to get new things in. So it's great if you can get an engineering firm to write a spec around your technology, then you just cut and paste that into the, say, here you go, just stick this in here. And, you know, but a lot of times the engineering firms are more conservative than the customer is. And you got to convince them before, and then they have the connections with the customer, and then they convince the customer. So it's there's a lot of stakeholders involved, as you mentioned.
Yeah, and that makes the barriers to entry higher, which was a challenge in the beginning, but I feel it protects us a bit more now. And I think like we were somewhat lucky, our strategy ended up working, which was like, it was not actually the engineering firms that we approached first. It was cities and contractors that reached to us with a problem they could not solve with anything else that was on the market. So when we provided that solution, then the utility company and the city were now open to it because it had been used. So when we approached the engineering firms, we told them like, hey, this is not something new. This actually, we've been doing work with the biggest aqueduct utility company in Colombia with this technology. So it's not something out of the blue. You are actually falling behind. You should be checking this out, all right? And that really helped to move things along, for sure.
So what do you, do you see a lot of kind of potential application, or is it kind of a niche market, you know, going underneath a highway, or, how do you see, I don't want to get into the details of the costing, but where does this product apply in general from a project perspective?
Yeah, so we focus on new pipeline installation. So there's no pipelines or there aren't any pipelines underground and you wanna, install some. That's our niche. It is a niche worth billions of dollars, though. So I don't know if it's proper to call it a niche. But that said, because there are many great technologies for pipe rehabilitation, we don't want to play in that field just yet. We have a prototype for a machine that will get into that, but that's going to happen in the near future. But for now, we're focusing on our core, where we had the biggest competitive advantage, which is installing new pipelines, specifically for sewer and stormwater lines, although we've done water mains as well. So where we are very cost effective is when you are excavating fairly deep, just because the cost of excavating increases by depth significantly, where traffic disruption, it's a concern. Like in cities, for example, or crossing highways or railroads, for example, you cannot excavate railroads. And then the third point is where soil conditions are really complicated for other technologies. So for example, unstable soils with a high water table are a real challenge for other competing technologies. And they, the machines that can do that are worth millions of dollars. I'm talking about anywhere from $1 to $7 million, depending on the machine, for that type of soil. So we started there, and now we're moving towards the more, you know, main market or the principal market, more regular stuff, as well as we build scale to reduce the cost of equipment. So right now, in some projects, we have saved up to 40% in versus the original budget of the city.
Oh, wow. So a couple of questions, just, you know, being a mechanical engineer, it's more, I'm curious. So you mentioned you can go below the water table with your device, which is really interesting. I was a little surprised at that. And then how do you avoid other stuff? You know, I mean, if there is something, or you know, sometimes you don't even know. A lot of times people, utilities, don't even know what's underground. I mean, you know, they don't know what's 5 feet under and 4 feet over there. So how do you, you know, is your device have a seeing eye that, you know, kind of detects something and says, oh, I got to go this way, or I'm going to stop? I mean, how do you, or do you just go blind? Is it a mole and just go blindly through?
Yeah. So that's also a very good question. And it's, I guess, the second that we get the most.
Yeah.
And there's a three-step process that you have to do before you start doing any of this transist work. The first one would be to try to understand where the other utilities are. You can go and like call a specific number. They'll provide where lines are located. That said, the first thing you're going to realize is that they are all wrong. Like all those plants are like messed up. So the second step is to manually check. So in our case, we're dealing with sewer lines and stormwater lines, which by design have to be the deepest type of pipes.
Right, right.
And by design, they have to have manholes involved. So at that depth, it's fairly easy to determine whether a pipe is there. And they go always on a straight line, that's for sure. So like that makes it easier to detect whether you're going to collide with another type of pipe. That's the second step. And the third step, and most contractors don't even do this because we're the first two that are fairly confident on what's down there. It's using a georadar to detect what's underground and verify if there's any other thing. I'm more concerned about, like, for example, finding a rock that was not, you know, foreseen versus finding something else, right? Like a utility line. So in terms of rocks, we have solutions to break them as long as they are not a solid rock, meaning like a bedrock. Like we cannot drill through bedrock right now. We only focus on softer grounds. And if you find an isolated rock, we put some special teeth on the front of the head, and the static pressure and the pipe rammer, it's like the best solution. So the impacts plus the static pressure is the best solution to breaking a rock. And so far we've been able to break and drill through many isolated rocks, even cobblestones, but we haven't tried, would not dare to try bedrock just yet.
Yeah, I might wait a few days for that one.
So,
I mean, you mentioned that you're up to 30 people now, which is, you know, a sizable group. With all the startups I worked with, and I worked for a startup as well back in the day, the founder's role has to change as the company grows. I've seen some founders embrace that change and understand it and roll with the change. And I've seen other founders that did not accept the fact that their role had to change. So I'm wondering which side of the coin are you on? First of all, you know, have you experienced that as the company has grown, and how have you handled that?
So I think we're starting to see that. And the reason is we technically co-founded a company in 2018, but it was only after I got to business school that we had gotten the initial seed stage money plus the grants to actually, you know, make it a reality. So let's put it this way. Company started working really in 2019, pretty much. Summer 2019, that's when it started like real operations. So with that said, we spent the second half of 2019, all 2020 and all 2021, getting the technology ready to hit the market. So at that point, the team was quite small. Like, you know, I think that at most we had like 12 people at some point. So we kept the team lean, and that's what you're talking about. It's a different mentality. That back then, my co-founder, Roberto, my brother, used to like go and like help building the machine himself, like, you know, hands-on type of work, right? At this stage, though, we officially launched in the South American market to start back in August, July last year. And it was there then when we started seeing massive opportunities. We ended up signing the first contracts in December because there's always a lead time there.
Sure.
So since then, we went from the 12 to, I think we're going to close this month with over 30 employees. We're at 25 right now, but we're already hiring, like, it's, you know, for 30, and probably by next month we should be hitting 40, if I had to project something. So now I'm seeing that transition, and let me tell you, I think it's a pain while you get someone to replace you, because now I gotta go and like hire someone to, for example, build the quotes that I used to do myself. But I'm much better, at least I'm much more passionate about leading a team than doing things just by myself, like without any help. So I'm actually excited for what's coming next, because I didn't enjoy too much having to do absolutely everything from HR to, like, you know, signing contracts to like make the payments on like the bank, you know, to taxes. Like everything was like myself, even the bookkeeping was like, I'm very happy that we're expanding and now I'm getting a proper team.
Oh, that's good, because I know a lot of people who like to do everything themselves and they have a really hard time giving stuff up. Tell me some of the things that kind of most surprised you. I know you went to the MBA to get your MBA at MIT, and you probably learned a lot of lessons there, but what most surprised you, or what didn't you know you didn't know when you first started the company? You know, what kind of things were just like, uh-oh, I mean, I wasn't expecting that. Or on the other hand, it's like, oh yeah, okay, I had that one down pat. I had that one in my back pocket before I started. I'm always curious to kind of hear, because everybody comes from a different place. Yep. Some things they know and they expect, and other things they just have no clue. And it totally surprises them. So I was wondering if there's any kind of big surprises that you ran into when you first started the company.
So that's, there are so many things that surprised me that I'm trying to point out to just one.
Yeah, well,
I think I always tell people this, and it's like, I always knew it was going to be hard. I never imagined it was going to be this hard. Like, it is just incredible. And I now have found a new respect for entrepreneurs that I, you know, that I always had, but I not at this level. Like, the type of issues that you face sometimes are completely unexpected. Like, being 2 weeks, at some point we were like 2 weeks away of bankruptcy. And like the stress that generated was like something I did not imagine going through. Now I understand also like why investors love to invest in second and third time entrepreneurs, because once you've done it, now like I look back at things and it's just like, you know that they're gonna be okay, and you know what to where to focus and where not to focus, and that makes things simpler. That's one thing that surprised me, like how hard it is, because there is always something unexpected that will arise. Always something going wrong. Right. So I guess that's the biggest. Like, I never imagined it was gonna be so hard, and if I knew, I don't know if I would have done it, honestly. So I guess that play in my favor at the end of the day.
Yeah, no, that's I guess that's one reason why I never became an entrepreneur, because my father was a small businessman, and he had to teach school to make ends meet, you know, most of the time. So I saw how hard it was, and I was like, nah, that's not for me. Not at least not until now. You know, now after I've kind of retired and, you know, my third or fourth career now, you know, doing what I do now, I'm finally to the place where I feel like I can take the gamble and, you know, kind of work for myself and be an entrepreneur. So I know this is probably a kind of a strange question to ask you, but because you're so early into starting your company, but do you have an end game in mind? I mean, you know, do you expect to for this to be, you know, the next, you know, multinational, you know, contracting construction company? You know, do you just see yourself in 5 years, you know, selling out to somebody? I mean, do you have an end game in mind?
So that's a good question. And right now it's hard just to say, because like we've been on this only 3 years. So it is a bit too soon to give up my dream. But that said, it's always one of the things, like I read a book that spoke about entrepreneurship, and it says the best businesses and the best companies are led by people who are selfless enough to know when their baby is going to be better off on different hands and like with a different type of support. So like all the decisions you got to make have to be selfless and not, you know, make them before it's what you would prefer, but it's what actually the company needs. So if something comes along that it's right and that would have let us have a much bigger impact with better funding and better, you know, market traction, like happy to explore that option, but it's not something we're considering as of today.
I know most of the funding agencies, you know, before they even invest in somebody, they already have an exit in mind. I mean, that's one thing I learned working with venture capital companies. So
we've got a few acquisitions offers in the past, which I kind of
already
but we just thought it was not the right moment.
I understand. So yeah, are you having fun? I mean, that's the biggest question. I mean, are you having a good time doing this, or is it still stressful for you?
It is very stressful, but I'm having fun. So it's a mix between the two. I'm actually, I was like much more concerned last while we were developing the technology than right now. Because like right now we have product market fit. We're signing contracts like crazy. Like now it's the growth stage that I always dream of. And I didn't know that it was going to take so long in my mind to get this ready to go to market. So it always takes more time, especially in hardware. But being hardware, it took us like 2.5 years to get it ready, which in the hardware sense is actually the fastest you've seen.
That's not bad.
Yeah. Especially for these type of equipment that are like heavy CapEx and whatnot. But I wanted to get to market sooner. So that was a bit frustrating for me in the beginning. Now that we're seeing traction, it's all about growing the company. So we're going to have to fundraise for sure in the short term to cope with growth, because that's the biggest challenge. But that's a challenge that I enjoy, like growing something as quickly as you can. That's much better than it's like, is the technology going to be fine? Like, is it going to work? So that it's a different kind of a stress. And I like this one much better for sure.
Oh, that's good. Have you ever gone back and looked at your original pitch deck and kind of looked at what your kind of growth projections were and to see if you're even anywhere close to that? Because, I mean, every pitch deck I see, you know, has a hockey stick growth pattern, right? Every single one. If you don't have that, you know, you don't even get a second chance. I mean, have you ever kind of gone back and say, hey, you know, I thought this was going to happen and it's taken longer, it's taken shorter. I mean, maybe it's too early for you to take a look back yet, but I'm curious as to how well you thought or how well you kind of planned your progression.
So the truth be told, the more time has passed, the better you get at estimating correctly. What was really challenging was to make projections before you had product market fit. Because it takes some time to figure it out, the tech to figure it out. And you expect it always to be, oh, so we're so close. And then you realize you're not. Like, you know, you got to go back again to the drawing board and like fix some things. And that in hardware, every time you got to do that, it's 6 months delay, right? So I think that versus the first plan I ever built, we're completely off for sure. versus the last one, we're not that off actually. So there are some factors that affect and some assumptions you make, like, you know, I muted for a second. So sometimes you think, you know, you make assumptions like, oh, I'm going to have the money from the round ready by X date. And turns out the market crashes. Like one thing that happened to us, it's like COVID hit when we were in the middle of fundraising. And what ended up happening is like a lead investor, I can't disclose who it was, ended up walking away from the term sheet. So like that did affect us quite a bit, delay our fundraising plans. Like, so there are always things that are unexpected that sometimes you in the financial model, you think they're going to happen and they don't end up happening, that delays you quite a bit. So long story short, we've gotten much better. But yeah, of course, when versus the first deck, it's completely off.
That's an important lesson, I think, for every entrepreneur to learn, is that your first deck is always going to be wrong.
And I think next time, honestly, I would do something that a few friends recommended that had more experience. It's like when investors ask for projections and it's an angel round or like a very small round, or you're not ready, like it's just an idea. You should not be talking about projections. You should be talking about market size. That's the biggest concern. Cause like whatever you project is going to be wrong. Like, but what could be right, it's the market size and the market opportunity. So if it takes you an extra couple of years to get there, it's not as bad if the market is big enough. Right. So I would have focused more on market size than projections for sure.
Interesting. So that kind of gets me to my last question. You know, what advice would you give, you know, somebody else who's considering starting, you know, a water focused company? You know, you got one or two pieces of advice. I mean, this last one was actually quite good as far as what to focus on. Anything else you'd like to, you know, maybe advise people on?
Customer traction, like in water overall, it's, and especially if you're doing hardware, maybe in software stuff might be easier, but in hardware you gotta focus on customers more than investors. You gotta find, because like investors tend to shy away from hardware companies unless you have decent traction and you show that you're building a company that has a strong financials and that you're thinking not about burning cash at massive speeds, but instead, you know, focusing on good unit economics, healthy growth, a healthy customer base. It's a different type of investors, and there's less of them. So like in that sense, what I would encourage people getting into this industry is to, I mean, yes, you need some capital, but focus a lot on getting those customers to support you by giving you money upfront, and like showing with the, you know, with their wallet that they're willing to believe in your technology. So I think that's the biggest message that I would give to new founders in this, you know, industry.
Thank you all for listening. This podcast was brought to you by Astera with additional support from Imagine H2O. The producer is Anna Gagliardo. Theme music by Gabriella Gagliardo. Yes, this is a family affair. Your host is Paul Gagliardo. If you have any questions about this podcast or the series, please contact us at thewaterentrepreneur@gmail.com. And please follow us on Instagram. We hope to see you again next time.